Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 239 featuring Marcos Fajardo, who you guys really should know. Very important person. He is the founder and software architect behind Solid Angle, the company that makes Arnold. In fact, he is the guy who created Arnold, which is pretty interesting. Obviously, I have actually known Marcos for years. He and I actually worked at Sony at the same time. Which is really kind of interesting. But yeah, I mean, obviously we're both in the rendering world and we have a lot of mutual friends. And Marcos and Vlado actually have a lot of mutual respect for each other. And when I told Vlado that he was going to be on the podcast, he had a whole series of questions. Really fun. Now, Kristen, you listened to this podcast, right?
Yes.
What did you think about it?
Oh, it was so cool. Yeah? I really loved it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty technical.
Yeah.
But there are some interesting stories. Yeah. What are some of your favorite stories about it? Well,
the thing I liked is how Arnold was named.
Yeah.
So I didn't know the person behind it was Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yes.
Yeah. And that was from, the End of Days movie after Marco saw that.
Yeah.
So I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, it was him and Andy Lesniak that were joking around about it, and they ended up naming it Arnold, which just stuck. Like it's one of it was supposed to be a code name, and then it just stuck. So, which is, by the way, same thing happened with V-Ray. V-Ray was a code name, and then we just ended up sticking with it. So it's kind of interesting to do that. Anyway, really fascinating guy. He came by the week after SIGGRAPH. He was still in town, and we were able to record it. Thank you so much, Kristen, for being so diligent and making sure that we do that schedule. It was really cool.
Yeah.
Okay, we've got some announcements. Go ahead and tell people about this cool V-Ray Cloud thing.
All right. So again, we have the Chaos Cloud sign up, and you can do this for a free trial and get 20 free credits. And if you do it before August 30th, you will be entered into a lottery to win 200 extra cloud credits. So go to chaosgroup.com/cloud.
Right. That's pretty cool. And what you said, August 30th, right?
August 30th,
So make sure you sign up before then to get into the lottery, mm-hmm. which would be really cool. We have another community event, an academic event. Go ahead and tell them about that one, too.
So this will be in our headquarters in Sofia, Bulgaria. So it's a Chaos Group Academy, and it's going to be 2 days, September 19th and 20th.
Mm-hmm.
And this will be for professionals, and it's designed for beginners and intermediate level people who do V-Ray.
Mm-hmm.
It will be a certification. It'll be based on for V-Ray for 3ds Max.
Right.
So fluency in English is required.
Is required. Okay, great. So where can people get information about that?
So they just go to chaosgroup.com/academy/professionals. You'll find all the information and tickets there.
Okay, that's cool. I also want to let people know that I will be going to THU as I do every year in Malta. I love it. It's one of my favorite events. And I will be bringing my podcast gear there, and I'll be recording a whole bunch of podcasts. So if you are going to THU, let me know, and definitely let's hook up. THU is September 23rd to the 28th, although I'll be going a few days early and leaving a few days late because it's tiring. Also, there was a really cool blog post that was put up by Henry recently about Rusty Hazelden, who did a bunch of V-Ray training stuff that's really cool, called The Art of V-Ray Volume 1, so there's more to come. He actually got in touch with me a while back about wanting to do that, so I helped him out in terms of getting him all the resources he needs to do those tutorials, and they're up now, so you should definitely go check it out. But go read the blog post, so just go to chaosgroup.com/blog, and you'll see that blog post about Rusty Hillman and the V-Ray training on The Art of V-Ray Volume 1. All right, guys, that's all we have. Thank you so much. Hopefully you enjoy this great podcast with Marcos Fajardo.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
I've been wanting to do a podcast with you for a while. It's been very exciting. Darren Grant's been telling me, yeah, you got to get Marcos on. X-Ray told me the same thing, and he says hi, by the way, because I was talking to him today about some stuff. And then I told Vlado, and Vlado was really excited about you being on.
Cool.
Which is great. And he said, and I said, do you want to ask him any questions? And he said, yes, I do. And so he sent me a list of questions.
Cool.
And so I was like, okay, this is really cool. But before we get to those questions, let's give people a little bit of an intro to who you are and what you've been doing, obviously. But it's usually good to start with a little bit of a backstory. People love the backstory. So the first time I ever saw anything that you've done from Arnold was Pippinland.
Yeah, back in 1999.
99 is when it came out?
Mm.
It was pretty amazing. It was the first time I'd seen something look like that before, ever. Yeah. And so how did that happen? Like, tell us the story of like how that happened.
Wow. See if I remember. So that short film was done by my friend, Daniel Martinez Lara.
Uh-huh.
He's not company, but his brand is called Pepe Land.
Mm-hmm.
And Pepe is the name of that little character, that clay character that he had been using for other short films and animation exercises.
Right.
So I was working on a very, very early version of Arnold. And, you know, it was just me doing spheres and cones and planes, you know, like typing the scene in ASCII. You know, it was like very geeky and very, you know, it wasn't very interesting.
Right.
But a friend of mine, Gonzalo Rueda,
he
started writing a 3D Studio Max plugin
for
Arnold. And I was like, yeah, okay, yeah. So we're working on that. And when the plugin was like usable, you know, like you give it to an artist and instead of spheres and planes, they start doing crazy shit, right? Cool stuff, like actual 3D models, like really cool stuff.
Right.
So my friend Daniel Martinez Lara, he was one of our first beta testers for that plugin. He was like, wow, okay, this looks great. Like he started doing little, you know, putting his models on a table and just doing that. It just looked great because I don't know if you remember the whole global illumination and skylight, that kind of thing. That back then, that was a new look. Like that was
very
really
new look. It's the first time you'd seen. Now it's very common, but back then, it's the
trivial.
First time people had ever seen anything like
right,
that.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And there's another backstory. That, like the first time I saw that kind of illumination from the skylight was at Blue Sky Studios.
Right.
So back to the animation from Pepe Land. Daniel was so excited that he said, this looks amazing. This looks so real, so tactile that you can actually touch this thing. You know, it looks so real that I'm going to try to make something real, something that feels for the real.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why he used, if you remember, the camera was like, it had this handheld shake techniques and out of focus and this kind of thing. So he wanted to make this short film look like it was shot on a handheld camera.
Right.
And he nailed that. He used like a device that he created with a joystick, and you know, he was like moving the camera and using the joystick to like add the jitter and shake like manually.
Oh, okay.
So that added to the effect of the realism that the render, you know, could do. So, you know, he released that in 1999.
Yeah.
I don't even know where he released it, just on his website or something.
Yeah.
And it just went viral. Like, you know, like back in the day, it was crazy. And I didn't expect that the success that short film had in the industry, but yeah, it was very influential. Like a lot of people remember this short and it kind of like opened their eyes to what we could do now with computer graphics.
Yeah.
So it was beautiful.
That was 20 years ago, dude.
It was 99, 20 years ago. It's crazy. So yeah, super happy that Daniel spent the time to perfect that little short film.
Right.
I mean, it was really short and really small. Like the resolution was like 320 by 240, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, but it just looked great. And it was animated so well, you know, like it was animated with taste.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just Daniel, by the way. Like a bunch of our friends work on that short, like Charpu, that went on to work at DreamWorks for many years. And a bunch of Spanish friends.
Right.
You might remember this guy, Pedia from the IRC chat where we all work hanging out.
Uh-huh.
He provided like support and help and even the website where we were posting some of these images.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, wow, this is like so long ago. And yeah, that was like the first short film that made me think like, okay, we could use this for like, you know, for like serious stuff.
But what motivated you to do Arnold? Because you said you were just sort of goofing around and writing a render engine on the side.
Yeah, no, I was studying computer science in Malaga in Spain.
Yeah.
And, you know, they teach you things like applied mathematics, like numerical methods and stuff like that. Right. It was a bit dry. It was very boring.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I could study that and I had no problems passing the exams, but it was just whatever.
Right.
So, like, in the computing lab in my university, I found these books about ray tracing and SIGGRAPH proceedings.
Right.
And this is like the early days of the internet, so I found like these shareware ray tracers.
Okay.
But this is like before open source.
Right.
It was kind of open source, but it wasn't called open source.
Right.
So there were a few ray tracers there, so I downloaded that code, studied the code, mm-hmm. you know, and I was like, wow, this is like the same numerical methods that teach me in university, but it's fun. You know, like I understand this much more clearer now with an actual application. Like I know what this is used for, and I can see the results in pixels, like in colors, and you know, it's visual.
Right.
And to me, that was more resonant than the drier things that they were, you know, showing in the blackboard in the university. So yeah, I slowly began to study more and more ray tracing and 3D computer graphics.
Yeah.
Because these ray tracers with source code, they came with a bibliography where they would point to like SIGGRAPH papers or like all the books and, you know, mathematics and physics books. And I was like going through that entire bibliography and just learning how this stuff worked. So that's how I slowly became, at night, I became an expert in 3D computer graphics because I literally spent 8 hours during the night when nobody, my parents was like making any noise, whatever.
Right.
I was spending the night just reading all these papers and books.
Right.
So of course I woke up like at noon or whatever. So I started missing the classes at university in the morning. So my grades were like going down. Like I actually failed a few subjects because I was just sleeping, you know.
Right.
So it was weird. It's like I was becoming this like crazy expert in something, but I was failing my university degree, and my parents started to be concerned.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I was like, ooh, okay, I hope this ends up being worth it.
Yeah.
So otherwise, and yeah, it was worth it. Then shortly after that, I got my first job offer in England.
Yeah.
And it wasn't in England. It was in Madrid, Spain, working for Reyes Infográfica, a computer graphics company that was doing things like Dirty Reyes, Cloth Reyes, and a bunch of different plugins for 3D Studio Max. It wasn't even called 3D Studio Max back then. It was 3D Studio.
3D Studio, yeah.
So I went to work there for 1 month. the guy that was running the company didn't get along with me or whatever, so he fired me after a month.
Okay.
He's like, I was doing things like volumetric fireballs. It was so slow. This is like on a 386 processor.
Right.
And it was just like, you know, hours to get like a little, you know, image of a fireball. So, the boss was like, what are you doing this for? Like, this is useless.
Right.
But that's like volumetric rendering, you know, like 20 years ago or whatever. Right. So it was way ahead of its time or whatever. So anyway, he fired me. And I went on to work at other places, and that was the start of my career.
Yeah. So Gonzalo, I know Gonzalo, he's Mundus Digitalis Gonzalo, right?
Mm-hmm.
I know, he's a really funny guy.
Yeah.
Really funny guy. So he helped you write the first plugin for Max?
He wrote it. Yeah, I didn't know any Max APIs or whatever. He was an expert in that.
Okay.
So we kind of like started working on that and yeah.
Right, right. And then eventually Arnold was something we saw, like that was the first time we saw it. So the story I heard is that it ended up being called Arnold because of, what's his name? Lesniak. Is that true?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I first moved to Los Angeles,
this
was like in 1999 or 98, I don't even remember.
Right.
I was hanging out with the guys from Station X Studios, which was like a spin-off from Digital Domain.
Yeah.
And, you know, I met a lot of friends. I made really good friends there.
Right.
And I spent like a few months with them.
Mm-hmm.
And this is like the first time I actually lived in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Coming from Spain, in Spain, the movies from Arnold Schwarzenegger are dubbed into Spanish.
Right.
So he's got a totally different voice, like a beautiful opera. Like baritone voice.
I can't imagine.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. Like everybody in Spain is raised with those movies and that voice. It's I'm actually a very, very popular dubbing actor in Spain.
Yeah.
I think he's deceased now, but
yeah.
You know, he's a It was great. Uh-huh. So I came here, and I noticed that we went to see a movie with Andy and right. all the friends called The End of Days, I think it was.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
I was like, what? This is Arnold's voice? Like, you know, this thick Austrian German accent.
Right.
It was hilarious, right? I mean,
yep.
it was hilarious. And then I noticed that everybody was like making fun of him and like imitating the Arnold accent. And right. like Andy and some of my other friends were like Arnold Schwarzenegger impersonators. Like, right. like they would be always like making those jokes and right. get to the chopper now.
Right, right.
You know, and I was like, hey, it just cracked me up every single time because they were doing it so well.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was like the thing. And I needed a code name for this software that I was writing.
Right.
It was called Render API, you know. Stupid, like the most stupidest name you could ever think.
Sure.
So I was like, okay, I need a new code name while I figure out a real name.
Right.
So the code name was Arnold, as an inside joke with my friends
right,
who
right,
were
right.
starting to see images from the work that I was doing. So okay, I'll call it Arnold, and that's it. I thought that was going to be just a temporary name while I came up with a more professional sounding name yep. like Light Blue, you know, Pro, whatever,
right,
you
right,
know.
Right, right.
But no, I just got stuck with it because
the same thing happened with V-Ray. V-Ray was a code name.
There you go. You know, well, I think what happened is that the first time you start posting images to the internet,
yep.
that's it. Like people start like talking about it and oh, look at these images, they're so cool. It's Arnold.
Right.
And now you're stuck with it. You're stuck with that name. So
yep.
I would never change it.
Yeah. No. At this point, it's well known, which is funny. But yeah, that's funny how you guys. I mean, I was like, really? And then Andy was telling me it's unfortunate. I mean, I'm sorry about Andy's passing, but he was so funny about it. It's like, yeah, I was telling Marcus, like, your render's so fast. It's so good to call it Arnold. it's a really funny story.
Yeah, here's a toast to Andy.
Yeah, anyway. Yeah, good guy. Very smart guy. Really
genius,
smart guy.
Genius.
He was a real genius, and yeah, really entertaining. Okay, so the other story I heard is that eventually and actually, this happened not long ago. People at ICT decided they want to start using some Arnold stuff. Obviously, Paul Debevec, when he was doing the Parthenon project and a few other things. And the problem was that Arnold was a Max plugin, right? And there wasn't an easy way to get it into Maya, or you'd have to translate everything from Maya to Max.
Yeah.
And so X-Ray said, we got to find a way to make this a standalone renderer again, right? So what was that about?
Yeah. So at that point, Arnold itself was just a C++, or not even C++, a C API.
This is one of Vlado's questions.
Right?
He said, this is one of his first questions, says, was it ever a problem that Arnold was written in C instead of something like C++?
Oh, we'll get to there
okay.
next, but yeah. So Paul Debevec saw the Pepe short film that year.
Yeah.
And I think that year he met me at SIGGRAPH. We met and we talked about his projects. And of course, I knew about his work on HDRI and image-based yep. lighting and all that. And I was like, whoa, this is really cool.
Right.
So, you know, we kind of like hit it off.
Mm-hmm.
He offered me a job to go work with him mm-hmm. on the Parthenon short film.
Yeah.
He was just about to start.
Yeah.
And yeah, you know, they work on Linux. They like the render farm.
Right.
It wasn't a big render farm. It was like 10 machines.
Right.
But it was Linux.
Right.
So Arnold did not run on Linux. So okay, first I had to port Arnold to Linux, and then
was that pretty hard?
It wasn't really hard.
Okay.
Arnold was made like the system specific calls and things like that mm-hmm. were very well encapsulated in a few small places. So it was relatively easy to make it work on Linux.
Oh, that's okay.
But yeah, we needed a command line executable.
Right.
Like until then, I didn't have you couldn't run Arnold. You could link an application to Arnold, but you couldn't run Arnold itself.
Right.
Because it was an API, a programming interface, not an executable.
Right.
So I had to write this command line interface.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was like, okay, we'll do kind of like RenderMan, where you have like rip files,
mm-hmm.
and then you have the PRMan executable.
Right.
So I'll do something similar. I would have an executable and a file format.
Right.
So I was like brainstorming ideas with X-Ray, like, well, what should we call the file format? And of course, you know, we were young and silly and funny. So like, well, let's call it ARF, like Arnold Render File. And then the binary version would be BARF, you know, whoa.
Right.
You know, I was like, you know, silly things like that. And,
right.
and eventually he said something like, what about us, like Arnold Scene Source? Yeah, okay, an ass file. And then, but then, listen, the executable is going to be kick.
Right.
So it's like kick Marcus ass, you know? And we were like, ha, 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 yo, that's so funny, man. You know, it was a joke. And,
right.
You know, I thought it wasn't going to be a serious thing. But again, I got stuck with it.
Yep.
So, you know, Paul kind of like, I don't remember what he said, but he accepted it, you know, uh-huh. It was okay. So you got stuck with ass files and kick executable. I remember that years ago, somebody at Sony, when I went to work at Sony for some movies,
right.
I'm not sure who it was, but there was some executive or some, you know, higher up that was like, what is this ass thing, whatever, you know, there were some concerns.
Right.
But eventually we sorted that out. And I got stuck with that. So that was the story.
I remember at DD when they had, you know, Voxel Bitch.
Oh, yeah. There's been a few. Yeah, names
so
like
it was
that.
Called Voxel Bitch, and that was really the name of the render for the Voxel render for that they wrote. So they changed it to Voxel B whenever they were doing a SIGGRAPH presentation. And then they eventually call it Storm. But sometimes you're stuck with those names.
Yeah. a friend of mine, Wojtek, he's a computer graphics researcher, one of the brightest researchers right now. He did something similar. He was working at the University of San Diego, I think, and he called his volumetric renderer, he was called Render Bitch.
Right, right.
So, you know, okay, whatever. We were young.
Yeah, yeah. You know. I don't think it's so bad to have some of that history in there. It's a good thing. So, okay, so you mentioned you went to Sony. So, because that's when you and I actually were working at Sony at the same time. You know, we used to go to lunch every now and then. I was working on Ghost Rider, and I think Monster House was the first time that we're going to start to use Arnold at Sony.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So how did that happen? What was all
well,
that
the,
about?
Well, the story was, if I remember, I was in Spain. Mm-hmm. I was working on I didn't have many clients. Like, this was like the beginning of my professional career selling Arnold.
So you were starting to make it a commercial product, right?
Yeah, like I had like maybe a couple clients, like a company in France called Micros Image.
Oh, Micros, yeah.
And maybe a couple of the smaller places. And Paul de Bebek, I would give him support every now and then. But I was running low on money, like I had no money. To the point that one month I had to ask my father to give me some to help me pay the rent for the apartment. So who was it? Yeah, luckily I found one customer just in the edge of time in Spain. It's like this animation company called Zinkia Entertainment, and they were doing this TV show called Pocoyo for kids, like for preschool kids.
Yep.
And that show kind of saved me. Like, if I have some money to pay the rent. You know?
Right.
But I was still doing like just pretty basic in Madrid. A friend of mine, Pepe Valencia at Sony, he was an animation director or supervisor or something.
Mm-hmm.
He's a good friend. And he saw the Pepe short.
Mm-hmm.
And
that thing did some good for you, dude.
Yeah. And he was starting to work with the director of Monster House, Kenning, I think it was, and you know, they needed this particular look. Like, the movie was going to be shot like if the characters were marionettes, like this tall, like a feet or whatever.
Right. So like a
miniature look.
Right.
And you know, for that at that scale, for the director, he really wanted that global illumination look. That until now, it wasn't really practical for movies.
Right.
In fact, no movie until then had been rendered like entirely with global illumination. So they were like very excited about this look. They also had other software packages that could do that, RenderMan and Mentoray.
Mm-hmm.
So they did their internal experiments with those other renders, and they decided that wasn't going to be practical at that point. It just wasn't, it was very slow.
Mm-hmm.
So they contacted me and said, hey, let's do some tests and let's see how Arnold performs with this, you know, scenes with this kind of geometry, and let's see how it goes. And so they took me to LA for a few months. We did some tests, and it worked really great.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the render didn't have many features at that point. Like,
right.
Didn't even have like, I don't know, procedural generation of geometry or even good texture mapping.
You know? Right.
It was really, really basic. But I worked really hard to add those features as we needed them. And they were very happy with the results, and they just decided to give it a go. It was a big risk because it's like an unproven render on that scale on a film.
Right.
So they took a lot of risks, but we assembled a really good team at Sony, like software engineers and supervisors. Mm-hmm. I remember it was Francisco de Jesus leading like the technology. He was a CG soup on that show, or one of the CG soups. And he was just amazing. Like, he would, any problem that we would find where I would be like, damn, how do we solve this problem? I don't have the resources to do this, or I don't know how to do it. You would find a way to like connect me to somebody or change parts of the pipeline to accommodate for like the lack of a feature on the render or whatever.
Right.
So it was thanks to Francisco that we could make this happen. And we hired two or three software engineers to work on to help me improve Arnold.
Yeah.
And what I did is I negotiated a deal with Sony so that those engineers were paid by Sony, but all the improvements over Arnold, we would both keep. So it was like a cross-license agreement, whatever, where I would keep the IP of the software, but they could use it for their own movies.
Right.
You know, it's like...
So how did that work? Because obviously, I mean, Sony would own part of Arnold and you would still be able to keep the how did that work?
It was a complex...
deal, yeah,
it
must
deal.
Have been.
It was like a 100 pages or whatever of a legal document.
Right.
Just the negotiation of that deal was like 3 or 4 months.
Right.
It was hard. Like I didn't have money to pay the lawyers. These lawyers were very, very expensive.
Right,
I didn't want to risk like having a shitty lawyer on this deal because this could be like the end of my career.
That's your baby.
So it was like, you know, $600 per hour or whatever. And I thought the negotiation of the deal would be like 1 week or whatever, 3 months.
Wow.
So, you know, all this money was like this debt. I was accumulating this debt.
Right.
I had no way to pay for that. Right. So if that deal hadn't gone through, I would be like in serious trouble.
Right.
So, you know, that was a struggle, and I finally got that deal done, and it allowed me to keep the IP of the software,
right.
And Sony would only be able to use the render for their own movies, but not sell the software. That was the main thing that I wanted to negotiate. That's because I believed in the software, and I thought that in the future I could set up a company to sell the software.
Right.
So that was the division.
So I could sell the software to everybody. So basically, Sony got their version of Arnold that they can continue to develop, which their version is different than yours by now.
By now, yeah.
Split apart, right?
Yeah.
So they've got their version of Arnold that they can do, but they can't sell.
Exactly.
And then you'd be able to continue working on your own company.
Yeah,
right?
That was the main thing. And it was very risky, like I said, for me. And I was like, am I doing the right thing? Because I could have gotten a lot more money for that software license if I had given them total control over the IP. That's what they wanted originally. But anyway, so I did it this way because I believe in the future that I could do a company with it. And it turned out to be a good move. It turned out very well.
Right.
But at that time, I was like shitting in my pants. I didn't know what to do. It's like me against this huge corporation. I didn't know.
Right.
You know, but it turned out good, so I'm happy it all worked out.
Yeah. Well, it was, I remember when you were, you know, working there, and there was obviously, you know, there's a lot of things like, I got to solve this problem of, you know, motion blur or something, or whatever it was. It was always some little thing that like, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Because it hadn't been used at that scale before.
Exactly.
Right?
You needed all these production features
that
I just didn't have time to do.
Right. So that must have been really good for the software too, just to be sort of battle tested in a feature film, right?
Oh, that's how the software went on from from a little tool for a non-professional tool to a professional tool,
right?
Thanks to the pressure that Monster House and the following projects put on the software,
right?
And thanks to the great software developers that we hired to improve Arnold. I remember it was Clifford Stein, Scott Schindemann also helped a lot.
Sure.
There was, you know, a couple of others. Eduardo Bustillo worked there for a little bit. Then we hired Chris Kula, crazy, amazing engineer. I mean, Larry Gritz also helped. Later on we plugged his OpenImage.io texturing system into Arnold.
Yeah.
So a number of people, really great people, helped improve Arnold.
Yeah. Okay. So how long were you at Sony while this was going on, and when did you?
So they hired me, and the idea was for me to be in LA for a year just to work at Monster House.
Okay.
But I kind of liked it there, and they liked the results of the render, so I was there for 3 years.
Three years. Okay, quite a while.
Like working on all the movies like Alice in Wonderland or Monster, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs.
Yeah.
And a few others. But yeah, that was great. It was like, it was a great, fun time in my life.
Nice.
I liked it.
Yeah. Okay. And then so when you eventually left Sony, did you decide, okay, now I feel like I can start my own company again and start to sell Arnold?
Yeah. So that was around 2007. Mm-hmm. Decided to move back to Spain. Mm-hmm. And started to like, okay, I'll now hire my own software engineers to work on, to improve Arnold and continue to sell it.
Right.
And yeah, I did that. I set up a small company in Madrid. It was just me. Mm-hmm. And my father was helping me with the financial stuff, you know, banking and payrolls and all that stuff.
Right.
Hired my first engineer, Angel Jimenez. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it just exploded from there. Just like every 3 months or so, I would hire somebody else. Like it was like slow growth,
yep,
but organic. Like the thing I loved about the way I did this in the beginning is that I was never in debt, mm-hmm, for the first time in my life.
Right.
So like the software was actually selling like to just a few clients, but it was profitable. So from the first minute, we were profitable.
Yep.
And that helped me, you know, there was less pressure. Like the financial thing wasn't a pressure.
Right.
So like I could concentrate on the good stuff, like the technology and like how, mm-hmm, to improve the software, how to, you know, research new algorithms and work on the stuff that I really liked, which is like the mathematics and the engineering.
Right.
So yeah, it slowly grew from there, very slowly. And at some point we had a plugin for Sofimage.
Yeah.
And all the Sofimage studios, you know, started using. Yeah. So that was great. Yeah. That's how the company started.
Right. All right. And then, you know, I did a podcast with Darren Grant. And part of that conversation was about sort of the Autodesk acquisition and how that went and how complicated. Like his job is like, okay, your first job in this, here is to help with this acquisition. And that must have been very, very complicated. But how did they approach you? How did that happen?
Well, a few companies had been knocking on our door for a few years. I'm like, okay, we should talk and we should talk about acquisition.
Right.
And I was like, I wasn't ready for that. I was having fun with my own company. You, mm-hmm, know, everybody loved us. And it was, mm-hmm, I didn't think it was the right time to sell.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they kept knocking on our door. Like things were, you know, getting better. And it kind of started to make more sense. So, yeah, after talking to Autodesk for 2 or 3 years, I forgot. We started to let's sit down and let's now seriously analyze what the implications of this acquisition would be and how, mm-hmm, can we do this and blah, blah. So, yeah, we decided to do it in 2015 or so.
Yeah.
It took like 6 months of like back and forth negotiations and, you know, it was tough. Like I had to set up a team to work on this deal.
Right.
The team was like my friend Sebastian Silvan.
Yeah, Sebastian, yeah.
Darren.
Yeah.
It was like you know, a bunch of lawyers and an expert in acquisition. I mean, it was a great team. So, you know, we negotiated a very good deal with Autodesk and we both were very happy with it.
Interesting.
And it happened in February 2016. I think that's when
the acquisition was
finalized.
Nice.
And yeah, that was a difficult decision, but I think it was the right thing to do.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's allowed you to sort of go back to focus on some of the other things and not worry so much about some of the business side of things that are going on, right?
Yeah, that was the idea. I would concentrate more and more on the research and the code rather than running the company, which I learned how to run a company, and I don't think I did a shitty job, but it's not really what I was born to do.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
So I can let other people deal with that now.
Yeah.
And also, like, I'm not the best manager. Like, I don't know how to say this. Like, I don't want to say that I'm an asshole, but I'm very, very laser focused on the goals, on what I wanted the software to be.
Right.
So, like, people working with me, sometimes they suffer because I'm really determined and I just go forward.
Right.
And no matter what. And I don't know, it's kind of, I know that it's kind of hard to work with me.
Right.
Especially at the management level. Right. I'm not easy to work with.
Right.
You know, like somebody who's like so focused on like an idea and a vision and wants to implement it. I don't know. It's like when people tell me like, okay, we should do this. And I'm like, no, we have to do it this way. You know, and there's this conflict there. And it's it was difficult. And I wish that I wasn't that difficult to work with.
Well,
but, yeah.
We all have our struggles that we're good, you know, or, you know, I deal with some of my own struggles of insecurity and all the other problems I have with. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you're not talented or you're not good. But I think it's good that you recognize that in yourself, actually, and that, you know, hopefully because of, you know, the acquisition, that sort of alleviates some of that stress that you have to deal with in terms of that.
Yeah.
That's really cool. That's really cool. All right. I am going to start asking you some more questions because of what it was. We actually already answered the Sony question here. He says, was it ever Sony's plan to go commercial at some point? But it wasn't because that was part of the deal, right?
Right. I mean, if Sony could have gotten away with it, they would have acquired all of the IP and who knows, they might even be selling software now.
Right.
But that's not what I wanted. So
I don't see Sony selling rendering software.
There was previous attempts at Sony to sell like post-production software. I forgot the name of this thing called Socrato or something.
Okay.
But so there was a precedent.
I mean, I guess they sold Katana to Foundry, right?
So, yeah, but that happened later.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Okay. The other question, let's go back to the first one. Like, so you wrote it. Is it still in C or is it gone to C++?
Well, yeah, when I began working on what was going to be Arnold, I was ANSI C, like the one of the oldest versions of C, like raw, pure C.
Right.
The reason was like that was the most portable language at that time. Like,
okay.
It was really easy to like port that to all of these platforms, like Linux.
Like Linux, know? Right.
One of the reasons why it was so relatively easy to port Arnold from Windows to Linux is just it was ANSI, Kernighan Ritchie C.
Right.
So, you know, that's how it started. These days, like today, the API itself, which is like the way you link to other applications, mm-hmm. is mostly C. It's still almost like 99% C,
right.
Which again makes it very easy to like use any compiler to link to any platform. That's why it was designed in C. In C++, you have to worry about a lot other things like what kind of STL versions and containers and stuff and compiler versions.
Right.
It's much more fragile when you link to a C++ application.
But what's the advantage of C++ over C?
Well, C++ is more expressive. You can say, you can write things in with a shorter amount of code, with little code.
Yeah.
So kind of like the code would be more, you know, maintainable, easy to read.
Right.
That's the plan. Some people go crazy with C++ and they actually go the opposite way and the code turns into like an unreadable mess and complicated template stuff or whatever.
Sure.
But if you stick to C, which is what I did at the beginning, it was understood by everybody in the industry who was a software developer.
Right.
That was the advantage of using C. Now, that's the API, the public API. Internally, in the algorithms inside Arnold, they use C++.
Right.
So we do use C++ like everywhere.
Everywhere.
Arnold, right? It's just that the public API, the link, the bridge that you connect with other applications.
That's the original core, in a sense, right? Yeah.
It's the public interface.
Public interface, okay.
The internal algorithms, C++,
right. Okay.
More and more today.
Yeah. Okay. And then I guess one of the other questions was Mac support hard to add?
3.3 Macs?
No, Mac. Like a Mac.
Oh, Mac. No, for the same reason, because everything was C. Compilers all understand the C standard very well.
Right.
It was very easy. The only thing that you would have to do specific to Mac was like the display window.
Mm-hmm.
Like the command line render can pop up a display window.
Right.
So you have to add some, you know, OS a specific pixel display thing in there.
Right.
But that wasn't rocket science, you know, it's nothing too crazy.
Okay. Well, that's great. So it really did seem like when you started that. Did you think about that when you started, or is that just because you knew how to write in C and ended up being an overall advantage?
I mean, yeah, I thought about it, but I didn't know that very well. I got a bit lucky, I guess. Before starting my own company, like many, many years ago, I worked for another rendering company in England, and they had a C API as well.
Right.
They were like, oh, okay, C API. Renderman had a C API. I mean, Renderman. You know,
right.
So those were my two inspirations, Renderman and this other render from England.
Right.
Like, well, if they both have a C API, I probably won't go wrong with C.
Sure.
Yeah, it turned out to be a good decision.
Yeah. Okay. So what else? Okay. He said, what was one of especially in the early days, what was one of the hardest problems to solve that you think of?
Wow. I mean, everything was an unsolved problem almost when I started. Just ray tracing performance, like the way you trace a ray through an acceleration structure to like find the closest triangle to intersect.
Right.
That problem, there were many published papers that explain how to do that, but the performance just wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
Or they wouldn't consider things like motion blur or many other features. So we had to do our own research on acceleration data structures.
Right.
So that was probably the biggest problem, because once you make your rays go fast, everything else in the render goes fast. So that was like the problem.
Right.
The other problem is the sampling algorithms. Not like how fast a ray can be computed.
Right.
But where do you trace those rays?
Okay.
Like things like important sampling
yep.
and stuff like that. That was the beginning of that field when I was starting.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to also come up with my own ways to do that, and we actually published some of those techniques ourselves, because I really wanted, like, I felt like I had to give back to the community of researchers that I learned from.
Sure.
So yeah, those are two are the fundamental problems, I think, in a ray tracer. Like, your rays have to be fast, and you have to know where to fire them so that you can fire less rays.
Right.
So
efficient.
Efficiency.
Right.
There's a third thing, which is like, or even a fourth axis, which are memory consumption.
Yep.
You know, in a ray tracer, you have to store all the polygons in memory at all times.
Right.
In contrast to the Renderman Reyes algorithm, where you only load what you see at any given time,
right,
every pixel.
Right.
So that means that for a ray tracer, it's even more important to store polygons in a very, very compact way, so you can store more and more polygons.
Sure.
So you can, like, counteract the fact that you can't store all the polygons that you wanted.
Right.
So you have to store them very efficiently. The other thing is multi-threading and parallelism. You know,
right,
like when I started, like, we had like maybe two CPUs, you right know, so it's like, okay, I'll write a
one
threading
CPU was
code.
One core.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, when I started, it was just one, but then 1 year we got like a machine with two CPUs. Like, mm-hmm. Whoa, two CPUs. I can make this thing go twice as fast. So yeah, of course I added like this multi-threading code.
Right.
And of course the next year we got a machine with like four CPUs and then eight CPUs. It was clear that was going to be like the future,
yep,
right? Parallelism. So I had to write efficient code to do multi-threading. It's easy to write bad multi-threading code, and you end up in a system where the CPUs are fighting against each other,
yes,
for control over the data and stuff. So it was tricky, and I didn't know anything about multi-threading, but I had to learn. And the people that were working with me were also really, really good hackers, and we all figured out how to do multi-threading.
But ray tracing can be very, Well, there's several ways you can do it, ray tracing, but ray tracing can be very parallel, right? It's actually really good at being parallel.
Well, yeah, every pixel is independent from every other pixel.
Right.
Like, you can compute one pixel.
But every ray is independent of the other ray, too, sometimes, right?
Yeah. Well, you only want to store the polygons once in memory. You don't want to store them once for every CPU.
Right, of course.
So there's like a shared database of geometry, and all of the rays from the different processors access that database. So in that sense, that could be a bottleneck.
Yes.
So we have to be careful about how to do this so that we minimize those bottlenecks. We reduce the time that CPUs fight with each other.
Right.
The other angle for parallelism was SIMD instructions. Like, even within one processor, we can do like four multiplications simultaneously with the what we call the SIMD instructions.
Mm-hmm.
So they're also called SSE on mm-hmm. Intel.
Yeah.
So that was another angle to get even more performance out of the CPU. So there's several critical sections in the code that have to be, you know, almost coded with like not C, but like machine, like assembly, like machine code.
Right.
Because those are super, super critical areas of the code, and we're trying to get like as much performance as possible by doing four multiplications at a time, four divisions at a time, four square roots at a time, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Today, in today's processors, you can do 8 or even 16 of these operations simultaneously.
Right.
With AVX and AVX2.
Right.
That's another thing that's really tricky to do well.
Well, let's talk about hardware changes, because a lot of hardware has changed since, you know, when you started in 1999, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now, obviously, you know, you have started to go do GPUs, which is something that you said you weren't necessarily going to be focused on GPUs, but now suddenly GPUs became an important part of what you do. So what was that transition like?
Well, I mean, writing code for the GPU is tricky because it's an entirely different platform.
Uh-huh.
So new code.
Yep.
So from the beginning, I knew that I did not want to have two separate code bases. I didn't want to have like a CPU render and a GPU render.
Okay.
So it's like, okay, then how are we going to do this?
Right.
It wasn't clear. Like if you try to do one single code base that works for both, mm-hmm. the code becomes more ugly. You have to have like sections of the code that only compile for the CPU and sections that only compile for the GPU.
Mm-hmm.
The code just turns into a mess. So for a long time, I was like very skeptic about it. Like, if we do this too early, we're gonna end up with a source code that's gonna be difficult to maintain in the future.
Sure.
So what I did is like I waited out mm-hmm. until GPU technology and the APIs were more established, and also to see like if there was gonna be a winner in the war between like all of these different manufacturers, like AMD, NVIDIA, whatever.
Right.
There were other manufacturers too. I forgot. There's always like new people wanting to do custom chips that they were knocking on our door and say, hey, Caustics, and for example, and a bunch of others, like dedicated, what do they call it? Dedicated processor for ray tracing and stuff like that. And these companies, well, they would come and go. very quickly. So we did not want to spend too much time on all of these platforms because that would be a waste of our resources.
Sure.
Our resources were limited. We were a tiny company, so we had to get the most bang for our buck when we write code. So yeah, we just waited out a few years until it became more and more clear that, you know, NVIDIA was kind of like winning the war.
Yeah.
And there was an API called Optics that makes it a lot easier for us to write that code. And that's where we are. Where we are today, we have GPU capabilities, but they're NVIDIA only for now.
Yep.
And yeah, that's it. Now the performance is great, and it's going to be greater. Like the GPU version of Arnold is still in beta. Like we don't recommend using it in production.
Right.
And because we're still like improving it and learning as we go, but it's already usable. So yeah, it's there.
So let's keep talking about hardware because you know I've been I got a crap load of NVIDIA GPUs that I. that I use and bang on every day. But it seems like there's some very interesting stuff happening on the CPU side of things right now, especially with some of these new AMD CPUs that are coming out recently. I haven't seen one. I haven't used one. I don't think they're out officially. But in theory, these CPUs could be really a major big thing. But if you're balancing your load or not, you know, not hedging your bets on CPU, GPU, basically your users can take advantage of them. What is your thoughts, somebody? Because some of these new EPYC AMD processors will have 64 cores in them.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. So the good news is that we already have code that's very optimally multi-threaded.
Right.
And we don't have to rewrite that code for AMD.
Right.
So it already works.
Right.
I mean, we might be able to squeeze like 10% more performance here and there by doing a couple things that are specific to AMD, but for the most part, the current code base already works great with AMD and however many cores. Like Arnold, by default, I think we compile with a maximum number of 256 threads.
Right.
And we can increase that as we go, but then we would use a bit more memory or whatever. So we tend to increase that limit every year or 2 years when there's new machines. And when a customer calls us and say, hey, I've got a machine with 120 or 130 threads.
Right.
But Arnold says that it can't do that. Well, okay, so we go to the code and like upgrade that limit to, you know. So yeah, the AMD CPUs, they're great. I'm hearing a lot of good things from our customers. So they're great.
I remember... So we have our V-Ray benchmark thing, as you know, and it goes all the results get posted on a website, so you can compare your hardware and see what other people's hardware.
Yeah, it's really cool.
But at some point, you go to the top of the CPU page, and you see some crazy machine that says it had 1,024 CPU threads, and I'm like, this cannot be a computer that someone. This is obviously someone in a lab at Intel or something that's got this crazy machine.
Yeah.
It's like it's completely impossible to do that. But yeah, it's amazing, you know, when things are really parallel to take advantage of that. I think that's the thing that I really, really appreciated. You know, when I started looking at ray tracers, and I did come from, you know, I was using RenderMan at the time, and it wasn't necessarily very multi-threaded at all. Back in now it is obviously because it's been rewritten, but it wasn't multi-threaded at all, and I was like, you know, what can't we use? And it's like, no, you have to launch the four different frames, one for each CPU.
Yeah,
like,
using four times more memory.
Yeah, four times more memory. So yeah, it was a little bit disadvantaged at that point. Okay, let me see what are some of the other questions he had here. Oh, yes, you mentioned Larry Gritz, right? OSL.
Yeah. Well, OSL was developed by Larry while he was, or I don't know if while he was at Sony or maybe a little before that, but around that time.
Mm-hmm. And was he doing that when you were at Sony? Or was it mostly OpenImage.io that was going on?
He was doing both, I think. Both, okay. He was working on various things. I
mean, right.
He likes to have his feet wet in different areas. But and he had a clear vision of what he wanted a new shading language to be.
Uh-huh.
And he was, you know, he wanted Sony to be the first place to be able to use that new technology.
Right.
So they did that. As soon as I left Sony, they started integrating OSL or the early versions of OSL into their version of Arnold.
Yep.
At that point, we diverged the code bases.
Yep.
They had their own repositories and I had my own repositories.
Mm-hmm.
So the code was still very, very similar, but slowly by adding OSL and rewriting the way the render talks to the shading system and all these things, the render became more and more different.
Right.
And I think I don't remember the first movie where they used OSL, but, you know, it was done there at Sony.
Right.
I did not integrate OSL as early because I was a bit skeptic, yet at the performance implications. I wasn't quite sure how that was going to turn out.
Right.
So I waited a few more years, like 3 or 4 years or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then eventually OSL at that point was more mature, more people were starting to use it.
Right.
So it was the right time to add support to OSL. I think that was in Arnold 5 couple of years ago or so.
Okay.
Yeah, it's great. You know, it works and it does what it says on the team.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty cool. That's really cool. Let me see. There was another one here that I was going to ask you specifically. GPUs, now we covered that. Yes, shaders. So materials, making the shader standard. Is that shader standard that you have now, the Arnold shader standard, do you feel that you had that shader can do anything you want, or is it going to evolve anymore, or how is that going to?
It's evolving. Like every now, like we have been discussing the interface for the shader with a bunch of other studios and developers and researchers.
Right.
And everybody has comments.
Right.
Because everybody, you know, feels that, that a shader that can be used for everything should have different things.
Right.
So we take all of that feedback into account, and the shader is evolving, and the specifications is public, and we're going to be evolving the specification of the shader.
Mm-hmm.
And the goal is for the shader to be as flexible as possible and do as many things as it can be as a general purpose shader.
Right.
It's impossible to do 100% of anything that you can think of.
Right.
But if it's like 90%, that's what we want. Like,
right.
You know, we're fine with that.
So it is basically a really good Uber shader, basically, in a lot of ways.
That's
so
what it is.
It is,
yeah.
Right?
It's like everybody was doing their own Uber shader. So like we thought, well, maybe we do now to desk and a couple of companies we could like agree on what this shader could be.
Right.
And it seems like it's getting some traction, and we'll see how it goes.
Nice. So over all this time, since the beginning of Pepe Land and all the way to now, as part of the Autodesk team and stuff, what do you think was some of the biggest successes that you've had, or like the things that made Arnold so successful?
Or some of the highlights?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. It's been so many years, but like that Pepe Land animation clearly was
a big
the first highlight and probably the most important one.
Yeah.
The fact that Sony trusted me to work on their movies with Arnold, that was also like a huge push.
Right.
Because of this deal that we had and like the engineers that they hired to work on and improve Arnold, that also took Arnold to the next level. I don't know, the Sofimash plugin was really nice because the Sofimash community, I love that community. It's like people who are like really, really, you know, it's kind of like, they had this ICE system in Sofimash that allowed people to be very creative with the way they set up systems and shading systems and all that stuff. And the people that were working with Sofimash, I don't know, they had something that I really loved. And they allowed me to jump into another level of like commercial success.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I remember one of the best deals, that I'm most happiest about, was the deal we had with Framestore. In London.
Oh, right.
That was difficult technically.
Right.
But it was very rewarding. The movie that they wanted to do was Gravity.
Right, I remember.
So, they did their own internal tests and, everything was really slow and impossible to do.
Right.
So I started talking to Martin Preston, who was the head of R&D at Framestore.
Yep.
And he liked to work with us because we were a small team and we were very responsive.
Mm-hmm.
And we got into an agreement where I set up one of our engineers, Ramon Montoya, he actually moved to London to work on site at Framestore, being their Arnold person at Framestore. So that was great because he could fix support problems, but he could also understand the complexities of their production and explain that to the rest of the team. And we would like improve Arnold with new algorithms to make that movie faster,
Sure.
Rendering. So that was really, really difficult and challenging. But the result, Gravity was just an amazing movie.
Yeah.
And you had to get the VFX Oscar and everything. And for us, that was like validation that Arnold could work in big films outside of Sony.
Right.
So that was also a
highlight.
That's true.
That was one of the big ones that was not long after you starting Solid Angle that came out, right? Really, well, first of all, it was beautiful. Really great work. What do you think people why do people gravitate towards Arnold? What do you think are some of the things that they enjoy about it the most?
Yeah, I mean, it's a usual suspect. It's like easy to use. It's fast when you have super complex scenes. Uses little memory for those complex scenes. And the results are, you know, I wanted to use the word unbiased.
Right.
But
I'm not going to go biased versus
unbiased.
Yeah.
Because you know then we're going to get stuck into that thing. But, you know, it's like the result, you get results that are, that you can rely on. Like,
sure.
Like you're not going to get, you know, artifacts that are not, you know, it's more predictable.
Yeah.
So those things, it basically what it does is it saves people's time. Like I remember this. Like I've gotten so many emails from our customers and friends saying, "Hey, Marcus, I want to thank you so much for Arnold. Not because it's great, whatever, but because it allows me to go home to see my family earlier."
Right.
And I was like, "Yes, that's exactly that's what I want." You know, when you do software that helps people and makes people happier,
good.
That's what you know. That's where you want to be.
Yeah. Well, what is your general opinion about like the competitive nature of renderings right now? Because I actually think, you know, I coming now on this, you know, working for actually for Chaos Group, et cetera, I've noticed there's actually a huge amount of respect that all of the developers have for each other. Not as much on the user side of things. You know?
Yeah, you know, there's always render wars and
right.
and religions and whatever, but... I mean, two things. So when I started, it was like what I did with Arnold was something new. Like there was no commercial render that did this. So it was like a new approach. Today, the majority of the renders, if not all of them, are essentially path tracers.
Right.
So that has changed a lot. Like there used to be like two very different ways to do things. Either scanline renders or ray tracers.
Right.
Actually there were scanline renders, mix scanline with ray tracing and pure path tracers.
Right.
And Renderman was a rasterizer, Mentalry was a mixed rasterizer plus ray tracer, and Arnold was just a pure path tracer.
Right.
So, you know, like I said, today, like everything is a path tracer. It's been
V-Ray has always been a path, started in 2001, so it was a path tracer for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, like today, all of these renders are much more similar.
Right.
Even the homemade renders at studios like Disney, Hyperion.
Right.
You know,
different concept, but it's still a path tracer. Yeah.
Slightly different ideas.
Manuka as well.
Yeah. Manuka is very special. That's things like pre-shading and a bunch of things.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially, they're path tracers. So the landscape today has changed a lot. And it makes it more, I would say, it makes it easier to improve, to advance the state of the art, because we're all working on the same problems.
Sure.
And the good thing is that... the majority of these companies and studios and universities, they publish their findings. So all of these published publications from all of the other studios and renderers, I can learn from those things and implement those ideas in Arnold as long as they're not patented or whatever.
Right.
And vice versa, we also publish some of our techniques and we allow people to use them.
Right.
And but yeah, like you said, I have a lot of respect for everybody working on high-end rendering because I've grown, I've seen my career improve along these other people too.
Right.
So, of course, there's a lot of respect. I mean, at the end of the day, we're just engineers and scientists. We're not like politicians or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
Just work on cool shit and it's great. When I learn a new trick from somebody else, that's the best thing that I can do. Just keep learning.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so when I was at SIGGRAPH, I went to one of the talks, which was, are we done with ray tracing? That was the name of the talk, which is a little...
When was that?
It was this last SIGGRAPH, just now. And it was a kind of a tricky title because what it really is, it's like, is there any other problems to solve with ray tracing, right?
Yeah.
And there was a lot of discussions that were interesting, but I'm wondering, what's your thoughts? What's the next like breakthrough in ray tracing that you see?
Yeah. Well, I didn't see this talk in particular, but every year or so, there's like a talk like that. Like,
right.
I remember one course or talk, whatever, called "Ray Tracing is the Future and Always Will Be."
Right.
You know, like saying like, yeah, we'll never use ray tracing for video games and stuff like that. Actually, it's starting to happen.
No, of course.
So,
well, the thing I always said is like, there's two questions I always say. It's like, will real time replace offline rendering? Yes. Will rasterized rendering replace ray tracing? No. Ray tracing is the end goal for everything, I think.
You know? I mean, it. So the thing is that if you forget about performance for a second,
right.
ray tracing is just the way, it's closer to the way the physical world works.
Right.
So that, you know, as you get closer to the way the physical world works, the whole pipeline becomes simpler because you don't have to fake things. So
right.
if you think of human time and the effort that we put in the pipelines, ray tracing is much easier.
Right.
For that, for getting our performance for a second.
Just do it like you do in nature and you move on.
Yeah, and everything is just easier to work with and you like the way things work and it's just easier. So that's the way, of course, that's the way we should work.
Right.
If the performance is not quite there yet, well, okay, then there's mixed solutions with rasterization and ray tracing or like the hardware manufacturers finally are putting special silicon to work on ray tracing algorithms.
Right.
Like that's what the new RTX card from NVIDIA are. And I think all the other manufacturers are trying to do something similar.
Something
I think
similar,
Intel
yeah.
announced something similar. AMD is probably doing that too. I don't know. Mm-hmm. So what was the question?
So what do you think is the next big breakthroughs? So new hardware is a big one. But what other things do you think has to be solved like in ray tracing?
I've been asked that question for many years. Like when I started 20 years ago, I remember a colleague at one of the companies I work with. He was like, why are you working on rendering? It's a solved problem. 20 years ago, okay?
Right.
We barely had GI, you know?
Right.
But, I mean, we had different algorithms that could do it, but very inefficient. It wasn't, you know? And I was like, what do you mean, Saul? There's still a lot to do. Like, the graphics we can produce now efficiently are really shitty.
Right.
Like, you know, of course there's work to do.
Right.
So I think we're still in that situation. I don't think rendering is a solved problem yet. There's a lot of little things that we cannot simulate yet.
Right.
And also, as the demands of the users grow, like for example, right now, if you're doing a video game, whatever, but if you're maybe an architect working on a special project that requires effects like polarization, or like a fluorescence, or like exotic optical effects like that, we can't do that.
Right.
So there's still work to do, and of course, efficiency. You know, the renders are much more efficient now. The hardware is much more efficient.
Right.
But the complexities of the scenes, the complexity of the scenes keeps growing.
Yep.
Possibly at a higher rate or pace than the hardware and the software advancements.
Right.
So that's still an open problem. Like there's every production that I work with on Arnold is like, no, this is like 10 times, bigger than the previous one. So that's still, you know, we still have to make things more efficient. It's like a never-ending race. I don't know when this is going to end.
Yeah. Yeah,
you can always, I mean, and in 50 years from now, who knows, like we might have quantum computers.
Yeah.
And our current algorithms are not going to work on that. So we're going to need to like start to think about algorithms for that.
Right.
I think a couple of years ago in 2006 or so, one of the consultants that I was working with at Solid Angle, Eric Johnston, he actually published a paper on how to do sampling on a quantum computer.
Yeah.
Because he was working with the University of Bristol on quantum photonics, and he had access to these like little optical circuits that could be used to do crazy things with quantum effects,
okay,
like superposition and crazy shit like that, entanglement, whatever. So it's like crazy, like this is crazy, but I think that's what's going to happen in 50 years. We're going to have quantum computers, and they're going to allow us to do, you know, hugely more complex calculations,
simulations, and complications. Yeah. And you think shading? What do you? I mean, obviously, shading is going to have to change too at some point, right? You think we can think of shading more? Because I still think like BRDFs that we still use the same BRDFs for a lot of stuff, and I think that they need to be evolved a little bit.
But I think they're evolving. Shading has always been evolving, and
right.
even today, we have a research group at Solid Angle, and we collaborate with a number of universities, like McGill, Montreal, or like Dartmouth University, or like. You know, a bunch of places, and they're always working on new BRDFs, on new scattering models, on new micro facet models.
Sure,
that's always improving. And maybe for like 3 years, you might not see a significant advancement in the commercial renders.
Right,
but then like the fourth year, you might get like recently renders have been adding multiple scattering.
Yes,
in the micro facets
right.
models, and that's amazing. It was great, you know. We didn't have that 5 years ago.
No, you're right.
So like every other year,
we've added GGX, and everyone's going like, "Oh my god, this has changed everything."
Yeah. So and I'm sure that in a couple of years there'll be a new one, and shading has always been advancing.
Yeah, I wanted You know, I remember when we first started using V-Ray, and I had to realize, like, oh, you know, specular and reflection are actually the same thing. It took me a long time to, you know, because I was naive and
young.
And I was like, okay, so if now if I make those the same thing, what I really want is to be no diffuse or specular, just be one continuous surface that the light scatters. You know, you don't separate those out as two different things. That's what I really think would be amazing.
Yeah, that makes sense. And from an artist's point of view, it's just one slider, the roughness.
Right,
But as you know, in practice, when you measure real materials, you might get things that look more, you know, complicated than a single lobe.
Right.
So you might have like a material that has like three or four layers or whatever.
Yep. Yeah.
And they behave like in strange ways. So that's why scanning materials is also a very interesting area.
Right.
I know that you guys have this beautiful library.
Yeah.
There's also, what's his name, Wenzel Jakob at the University of, I think it's EPFL in Switzerland. Mm-hmm. He's got an incredible new robotic arm scanner thingy.
Right.
That's like, he's creating a new library of materials with that. That's like really, really amazing.
Nice.
So that's another thing that I would look into.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, listen, we've been talking for an hour, but I want people to know. So, what, just before we go, it's like, what is, now that, you know, obviously, you know, some of your responsibilities have moved out and of Arnold, I mean, from being a manager, what are some of the things you actually do at the company now? What are some of the things you focus on?
Yeah, a bit of everything. Like, I like to read a lot and explore things. I still review a lot of the code and like, there's anything that I feel that I should help with in any area of the code, I talk to the individual developers and try to help.
Right.
But yeah, I'm just looking around and trying to see if I can come up with something new, and because I think that's probably the areas where I can help the most, like try to look for new stuff.
Yeah.
And also, like, I love visiting my customers and talking to them and see what their problems are, take notes, and you know, buy them a drink.
Yeah, that sounds great. That sounds great. I know your love of sushi. Every time there's always going to be an Arnold party, it's always going to involve sushi of some kind, which is great.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's my second job, sushi connoisseur. Yeah.
Sushi connoisseur, yes. Excellent. And LA's got some really good sushi.
Oh,
so.
Yeah. Sushi Ginza Onodera. That's in, where is it, Beverly Hills somewhere?
Oh, yeah?
That's where you have to go.
Oh, okay. Well, I live in the Valley, and there's some really good sushi in the Valley as well. So, but yeah, that's great. Well, Marcos, thank you so much. I know that it's been really awesome. I was really looking forward to doing this podcast with you, and I think it's really great that you're able to do it. Sorry you were sick, but looks like we're just in time. We're able to do the podcast. When are you going? You're going back to Spain?
Yeah, Sunday, which is in 2 days, I think.
Yeah, okay. So it's great. But thanks so much for doing this.
No, thanks for having me. This is a great setup that you have here with the podcast and everything. This is great.
Thanks, man.
Yeah. All right, see you guys.